Saturday afternoon, 4th August, 1973. There are two basic doctrines which are common to all the religious teachings of India particularly, and also some other parts of the world. And they are named karma and rebirth. These doctrines have appeared occasionally in the Western world, and not in too disguised a form, with the entry of Kabbalistic teachings into Europe. Particularly through the teachings of that great Jewish mystic, Abraham Abu Lafia, who was a contemporary of Moses de Leon, who compiled all the Kabbalistic traditions which come under the generic title of the Zohar, the Book of Splendor. Abraham Abu Lafia, who was a contemporary of Moses de Leon, they were contemporaries also of Dante, St. Thomas Aquinas, Albertus Magnus, Eckhart, Tauler. It was an absolutely extraordinary age then, that late 13th and early 14th century in Europe. Abraham Abu Lafia taught what was extraordinarily similar to yoga as the practice for discovering God and the ways of God and creation. And in the Zohar too, you find this idea of transmigration coming in, definitely coming in. Now these teachings, as far as we know, originated somewhere between the lands which lie east of the Caspian and the Fertile Crescent, the Euphrates-Tigris region, and the Himalayas and the Indus Valley. What the original teachings were has never been recorded, either as ideograms on clay tablets or on parchment. It was a great oral tradition. And it was only centuries later, in fact many centuries later, that these two doctrines which we now know as karma and rebirth took their present intellectual shape and became popularized. What has come over into Europe and the Western world generally is the popular belief regarding those two teachings which prevailed in India. The early missionaries and scholars asked the people what they believed. And the people were not enlightened holy ones. It is true, they were priests, they were pandits, learned Brahmins, and they were the general populace. So it is in the form in which they express to their beliefs that these two doctrines named karma and rebirth came into Europe and attracted attention and received acceptance in various parts of modern Europe by, after all, what is only a minority of the people. It's necessary to know this before we consider the meaning of karma in detail, in depth, I should say. Rebirth is an accessory of the teaching of karma. And the teaching of rebirth depends upon the teaching of karma together with the belief in the survival of some permanent entity, which is called the Atman or Ego or Soul or whatever you like. Those two beliefs are necessary in order to produce the idea of rebirth, understood as reincarnation. Now, first let us look into karma. Because if karma weren't there, and the whole concept and understanding of karma, rebirth would disappear also. What is the meaning of this word karma? Its Sanskrit root is kri, and the ordinary dictionary meaning, the literary meaning, as well as the popular meaning of that root is to do or to make. A better English word really is to create. That's the meaning of the root, kri. To create. Not merely to make or to do. To make implies generally the putting together of certain things and bringing into being a particular pattern. That is making something. To create has this special significance about it, that it is the consequence of a sudden upsurge of creative power, which we don't know. It is the unknown, it is the unknowable also. An upsurge of creative power, which, going back into itself, becomes the container and the contained of that creative power. And it is this type of action which is the origin, as the great teachers put it, both of what they call the spiritual universe as well as the material universe. And remember that in those days they always separated spirit and matter, because they could not see that matter is actually no other than pure energy. There wasn't enough scientific knowledge in those days to know this for a fact. All honour to those great Upanishadic teachers who, in the presentation of their teaching of Brahman, rode over all limitations whatsoever and said, Brahman is the absolute all. Material, intellectual, psychological, mental, spiritual, whatever you like to say, as a one reality. Those were the only people who said that. But people normally separated the two. They conceived of two universes, a spiritual universe, which was the paradigm, the prototype of the material universe. And it was assumed that the material universe was drawn out of the spiritual universe and created by great spiritual intelligences whom they personified as beings. So you get these great orders, the archangels and the angels, the suras and the asuras, the constructive powers, the destructive powers, you know, the demons and all the rest of it. These were the conceptions which people put out regarding creation and the creative process. Now, in those days, they did not know the meaning of words like integration or of transmutation as we know them today. They hadn't enough mathematics and enough scientific knowledge and enough experimentally verified and verifiable facts to understand with the mind the reality which underlies transmutation or integration or creation. Now these things must be very clearly understood by us today if we are to understand just what we mean by karma and rebirth. Good. Now, first of all, they presented this universe which is an evolution of the ultimate real, the mystical nothing, as they called it, the incomprehensible, unimaginable deity, if you like, of whom or of which nothing can be predicated. That mystical nothing, by some extraordinary process, they generally call it a wrench in its own being, or, as they put it in India, by self-limitation, becomes manifest. It, which has no appearance whatsoever, no shape, no form, no dimensions, no measure of any sort, becomes self-limited, and in that, because of that constriction, it puts out an appearance of itself. So the entire manifested world is an appearance of the of that which never appears, which remains everlastingly unknown and unknowable by you or by me. This was how they presented the whole process. That appearance is the totality of the manifested world. Now, this creative power which can make this upsurge sink back into itself and thus produce its self-limitation, its own container in which it itself is contained and therefore to that extent constricted, this creative act is action in eternity. No space, no time, no limitation, nothing at all. It is without cause. It is acausal. This is a very important point to bear in mind. Causality does not apply to it. It is consequenceless. It is the absolute will, if you like. The absolute will at work. And the whole of the process of appearance has been metaphorically, poetically described in India as the leela, the play, the sport of God the Creator, Brahma. That is how it has been described. Remember, it's acausal. It's consequenceless. There is no reward, no punishment, no adjustments, nothing to make. God is absolute God. What is the nature of this creative activity? It is of the nature of a pulsation, which is a life-death pulsation, but which I always prefer to call a life-other-life pulsation, at an incredible speed. This life-other-life pulsation means, because we use the term life only in relation to life which is manifest, actual living beings and so forth, is a pulsation of being, non-being. A pulsation of finitude and non-finitude. Now this is action in eternity which has no measure, no dimensions whatsoever, but produces all measure, produces all dimensions. But the moment it produces measure and dimension, space, time and substance and all the rest of it, the laws for the maintenance and subsistence of this appearance come into being at the same time. This is what is known as the order of the universe, Ritta. Now, as and when the law is not fulfilled, there is a break. There is a strain, there is pain, there is sorrow. Insofar as it is obeyed, the law is not abrogated, or the law, no one goes against the law, there is well-being, there is harmony, and so forth. Now, human beings, after this terrific realization in deep states of consciousness of the nature of this creative action, naturally interpreted this functioning of the law as a mode of equilibration, of balancing up. Now the human intellect came into play and said, oh, why should this be so and why shouldn't it be like this? Justice demands that it should be thus and thus. And so the various conceptions of a law, which they call the law of karma, action, remember, is its fundamental meaning, came into being. This adjustment process, according to human concepts of justice. And this is where its utter falsity comes in. Because God doesn't ask us how I shall adjust matters in the universe. He doesn't even try to. God is absolute, acausal. If out of the great religions, perhaps only Islam, in its presentation of Allah, has presented God the absolute with that terrific, stark, impossible to face and answer, absoluteness. But you look into facts as they are, and you will see that that is closer to the reality than the God which we create in our own image, who is going to be just as we think justice is. You see, ours is a shopkeeper's justice. These are the goods, they are worth £2.35. So you pay, give £2.35 and take the goods. Now, justice. That's just and fair. All this idiotic nonsense. You are a saint, I am the world's worst sinner. We are walking along arguing about this, and so absorbed are we in these cobwebs of how the divine runs the universe, that finally we take the step which takes us right over the 2,000-foot precipice. Neither God nor our concepts of justice save both of us from coming to the identical end, although, according to justice, I ought to be punished and the saint ought to be rewarded. No, we both come to the same end. A little bit messy. Now bear this in mind very carefully. There is no such thing as justice according to our human petty little concepts of justice. They apply only in the human context, and that too not in the context of the whole of the human race. What is justice in England is injustice in France, perhaps. Certainly it would be injustice in Russia or China or Timbuktu, and vice versa. We must clear our minds of those concepts, these petty concepts of equilibration, of putting things right, squaring the accounts, seeing that both sides of the ledger book properly balance each other. Karma is action, from the word kri, to create and to act, action. It's creative power. No one can predict or foresee just what will happen as a result of this creative power coming into play. And that's that. And if we don't like it, we just have to lump it. Invent petty little, pretty little doctrines like karma, which of course puts everything right and consoles us according to our self-oriented outlook upon the universe. All those are only harmful to us. Make no mistake about it. So you see, this little idea of adjusting things came into a being, and associated with it was the perception that there is a thing like growth and change and coming to fruition and so forth. And the doctrine was propounded that man gradually grows out of an evil state, out of an ignorant state, out of an unhappy state, into a good, a perfect, a blissfully, everlastingly happy state like you have in the fairy tales, and they lived happily ever afterwards and so forth. See? And in order that that may come to fruition, obviously, it cannot be done in a single lifetime. Therefore, that man must be born again and again, climbing step by step till he comes to the top class, gets his PhD, and then frames the certificate on his palace wall in the heavens. I'm sorry, I'm being very scathing and sarcastic. But really, such havoc has been wrought by this misperception of the actual process of life that it is time we just completely cleaned out our minds of these misperceptions and false presentations of what comes under the word karma. Now look, this is a creative process, an action in eternity. Within the limited context within the context, that is to say, of appearance, of form, of shape, of living things which grow, which means which change, and they change according to certain developmental trends which necessarily take them to a certain climax of perfection of appearance, of form, of organism and so forth. Within that limited context, of course, some of these ideas which we hold in connection with karma do operate and must of necessity operate. But those ideas, whilst they are quite legitimate in that sphere, are bedeviled at the source by relating them specifically to a surviving, a perpetually surviving, identifiable entity called me, the person, the ego, the immortal soul, the mannequin Atma of the later Upanishads. The later Upanishads were rather unfortunate that way. In fact, the greater Upanishads were responsible for using certain metaphorical expressions. This Atma, which is smaller than a grain of mustard seed, which is larger than the largest thing that you know, which is seated in the heart, which is the size of a thumb, seated in the heart. Well, you see, poetic little phrases like that got misinterpreted in terms of, oh, this mysterious something which is a spark of the divine. I know of no spark out of any fire which ever continued. It just sparked and that was the end of it. You see, phrases like this have been used, and the idea of the perpetuation of the identifiable person, the I am I, unfortunately came into being. You must remember this very, very carefully in connection with the process. Everything gets oriented to this little ego. We are all unwilling to give up our own egoistic existence. We cling not merely to biological life, but we cling to the survival of what the mind postulates as the permanent self. The entity, which is always something formed, something limited, something particular, has no option against death. Absolutely no option. An entity may come into being, but once it has come into being, it is absolutely inevitable that that entity shall die. Now, it's a strange fact that in Hindu teaching itself, you find this absurdity of the permanent entity coming on life after life and so forth, and these rather childish presentations of adjustment of debts and all the rest of it, rewards and punishments and so forth. This very Hinduism has also presented the fact of death in no uncertain terms. God the Father, Brahma, the Creator, goes through his lifespan of 311,040,000,000,000 years, and then he dies. Then after Brahma, Vishnu takes on, goes through his span, and he dies. And then finally Shiva takes on, and finally he also dies. It's extraordinary that they should have presented it. Their great teachers had the insight to know that anything presented, anything named, one of Adam's unfortunate mistakes, if one may so put it, was to name everything. And he couldn't name the one other thing that would have been a help meet for him, suitable for him. Well, don't let me digress into that. We'll come back to this. All the gods die, and then there is this marvelous pralaya. That is to say, the sleep of the entire universe, material and spiritual. And then the whole thing starts up again. So, of course, when questions were asked, how does the whole thing start up again? All sorts of ideas were invented. The karmic effects of the previous universe come into being now. But if there is an absolute pralaya, when there's the absolute cessation of everything, how on earth do the karmic effects of a previous universe come into being? It's quite impossible. You see, people never think. They just swallow. They don't look at what they swallow. Then when they get a bellyache, they come for enlightenment and so forth. But don't swallow doctrines. Look at everything with an open mind. Neither swallow it nor reject it out of hand. Consider it. But consider it with your own mind free, which means empty of preconceptions, assumptions, biases, prejudices. See? If you have such a mind, in fact, you will not ask so many questions. However, that's another matter. Now, this is the sort of general process by which these two ideas about karma and rebirth came into being and found expression in the popular mind. And remember that the mind of the populace is not much larger than that of an ant. And so everything was just absurdly presented. What did the holy ones themselves teach as regards this process, this universal process, the great becoming process, which is the expression, which is an appearance of this creative energy, this creative power in action? Remember, it functions as this pulse of life, other life, being, non-being, finitude and infinity at an incredible rate. Unfortunately, I have to use the word rate, which belongs, or speed, which belongs to the limited context. I have no other means of talking of that which vibrates in eternity. You can sense it. If you ever are successful in entering those states of consciousness. I have myself used the term action in eternity. But you see, if you try to analyze it intellectually, you can easily get tied up in knots, and you tie me up in knots too. These things are very difficult to talk about. However, now what did the perfected holy ones themselves say? And they were very chary of the words they used. The Buddha probably used the best word in the situation. He called it punnabhava, an again becoming. That's its literal translation. Well, what could be the meaning of this again becoming? If we want to use perhaps what seems to me anyway the best modern English word for it, it is a continuous emergent process. It is an emergent process of an extraordinary nature. It is something like, it is a little bit akin, or shall I say related to, the scientific presentation in the early part of this century of the nature of energy, that it goes out in pulses like that. It is not like a river or a canal in which the water flows continuously. It goes in pulses. It is an in-out thing. It is a pulsation, a vibrating, in the real sense of the term. See? This emergence is not a repetition. It is not a repetitious process. It is a perpetually creative process. Which means that the outgoing pulse, let us say, is the creating one, and there is a universe. And the indrawing pulse is the disappearance of that universe. Being, non-being. Being, non-being. But there is no repetitious reutilization of old material, because that old material completely disappears in the non-being. Finitude absolutely disappears into non-finitude, infinity. You see, one of the best hints, one of the finest clues that I know in the old writings to understand this is in the Gita, when Sri Krishna says, "Being and non-being am I, O Arjuna. Death and the origin of all things to come am I, O Arjuna." Being belongs to the limited, the particular, birth, death. Non-being knows no birth, death. How can non-being either be born or die? It can't know birth or death. And if Sri Krishna says, "Being and non-being am I," what is the significance of it? You must go into profound meditation in this connection. I'll admit I was very fortunate when this really sort of flashed into me. Somehow the whole thing came clear as light at once, just about 2 years ago, a little more I think. Being and non-being am I. Death and the origin of all things to come. What is death? This is the important point. Death is the extinction, the absolute extinction of continuity, which puts it in line with pulsation. The life of a life pulse. So that no such thing as an old survives to go into a new and reappear. Every single pulse of creation is totally new. This is something which the world has to wake up to, and it'll probably be a few centuries before the mind of man will ever really get hold of this. You have to experience it. The creation is totally new every time. And it is of such a nature that I can only say that the word timeless applies to it. That's why I say that in this supreme state of samadhi, the ultimate realization of transcendence, you are actually in the spaceless, timeless depth of eternity. Spaceless, timeless depth of eternity. These phrases are not mere words. They are realizations. Now, perhaps the intellect can be a little bit free of its misconceptions and suggest in the least misleading words what Punna Bhava could imply. This again becoming, this creative, emergent process. Not quite like Lloyd Morgan's philosophy of emergent evolution. He was one of our great philosophers in the early part of this, beginning of this century. But he got got some feel of it in his philosophy of emergent evolution, just as Bergson did in his way with his creative evolution. He got an intimate touch with the nature of life. But neither of them, simply because they were philosophers and not religious people who actually were able to experience transformed consciousness, they didn't get this innermost depth which it is possible for man to get hold of. So, this punna bhava, this again becoming. Now bear in mind, I said new creation. But when the new creation comes, it has to, when it limits itself, it forms certain patterns. And these patterns have certain tendencies inherent in them, otherwise cosmos could never come out of chaos. And these patterns bear similarities to previous patterns in the limited context, not in the transcendent context. In the transcendent context of absoluteness, I shut up where that is concerned. I don't know at all, never can know. But one can see something within this limited context. And because these relationships do exist, because curious bits of evidence which our conditioned minds cannot explain otherwise exist, therefore we spin out this idea of a continuity of an identifiable, immutable entity, called the immortal soul or spirit or person, through time and space, till he reaches a fruition. Nirvana, the kingdom of heaven, perfection. The picture is painted to satisfy heart's desire. Well, what can you do after the picture is painted? After all the marvelous delight and wonder of painting it and all that went into bringing it into being, all that you can do is to hang up this corpse on the wall. And then you worship that which is dead. So beware of the popular presentations, even the well-reasoned-out presentations of all the commoner garden doctrinal presentations of karma and rebirth. There is a profound reality which underlies those words. But the way those words have been expounded have hardly any relationship with that profound reality. You must first experience for yourself the nature of this pulsation of life, other life, of finitude, of non-finitude. And if you are blessed ever to experience that beatitude, you will find that it will, like a flash of lightning cleansing everything, it will clean up the whole of the intellect in a most remarkable way and free you from a terribly binding burdensome conditioning. That is not the way things happen. You see, in the history of the development of Judeo-Christian teachings, this problem came up. The Old Testament was supposed to stand for the law and the prophets, and the fulfillment of the law. But as St. Paul said, through Jesus Christ there came grace. Now the point is that grace does not annul the law at all. What Jesus Christ did was to introduce a new dimension into the religious consciousness of those peoples who lived in the Middle East. A new dimension. A dimension which was far from absent in the Kabbalah itself. Grace, hesed, mercy, loving kindness. Hesed is the word in the Kabbalistic teaching. It is precisely what Jesus Christ brought into prominence. In the law, hesed had as its counterbalancing feature gevura, which is judgment. The Kabbalistic teaching had the mediator, rahamim, compassion. Note very carefully, compassion, which mediates between loving kindness, mercy, absolute forgiveness on the one hand, and absolute justice as defined by man on the other hand. The working of karma in the real sense includes all these things. But unfortunately, as presented in India, it does not include all these elements. The original Veda had the whole teaching, just as the original Kabbalah had it. But it was forgotten. So this compassion is also, rahamim, is also named tifereth, beauty. This rahamim or tifereth is the son, S-O-N, son of the Father in heaven, the transcendent, the absolute, of which nothing can be predicated. And when the Son comes into being, He comes into being in each and every one of us when this consciousness, this awareness of grace, unifies, integrates mercy, forgiveness on the one hand, loving kindness with judgment, stern judgment on the other hand. When that is integrated, then the Son, the Christ consciousness as it is called, comes into being. This is also the compassion which characterizes the Buddha nature, the Mahakaruna of the Buddha nature. And it is always associated, symbolically only, with the heart. You see? Now, how does karma operate? No longer as the 100 pence for the 1 pound note. No longer at all. Both aspects operate. Remember that marvelous parable of Jesus, the fellow who comes at the last hour, like so many of our modern shirkmen, get paid the same as those who came and worked through the day from the first hour, the workmen. You see, strange are the ways of life. We have to understand and learn from them all. In order to understand all these, as I said, somehow understand and get this real flash of inspiration regarding this life, other life pulsation, being, non-being, finitude and infinity. Once you get that right, it clears the intellect of all its misfunctioning. The intellectual machine doesn't work properly. But once you get this, it will work properly. Then all the misconceptions of karma will disappear. And with them will disappear this idea of the permanent entity. There is no permanent entity, because the nature of creation is this pulsation, the totally new, in which the totally new comes into being. Different, therefore. Now, it's an extraordinary fact that in very recent years, the last 15 years, great scientists and mathematicians, they are actually mathematical physicists as such, have presented a new conception of the nature of what we call matter. Our conception of matter, due to our experiencing matter in the way we do experience it, this sort of thing, hard, solid, impenetrable, continuously there, and so forth. That's how it is experienced by us through our senses. Therefore, as far as our sense perceptions and the instrumentality of our sense organs is concerned, we can't know any different from just this fact. But, as you all know, the beginning of the century saw the breakthrough into the world of the atom. That microcosmic world where the laws of the macrocosmos were no longer obeyed. The causality, action-reaction, you see, reward-punishment in terms of karma and so forth, does not hold in this intra-atomic world. This element of free action, a-causality, and so forth, comes into play altogether. And it is of this world that the macrocosmic world is composed. But the macrocosmic world, as observed by us, seems to follow the laws of causality as presented in classical physics and classical mechanics, the science of mechanics. Newton was the one who sort of formulated the three great laws of motion, of which the last one was action and reaction are equal and opposite. If you press against this bookcase with a certain force, that bookcase is pushing back at me with an identically equal force. That is why there is no movement, or there is no such thing as my finger breaking through this piece of wood. That is the classical law in mechanics. In the world of the atom, that thing doesn't hold. And now this new conception which has been presented is something of this nature. That if you take the microcosmic particle, the intra-atomic thing, it doesn't exist merely as such. It is continuously throwing out what is called a virtual particle, ejecting it, and immediately afterwards reabsorbing it. In other words, it has a life rhythm of its own. It has a pulsation of its own, a life rhythm. These physicists openly declare that the entire universe is alive. And the mathematical physicists can calculate all this. They arrive at these conclusions through their mathematical calculations. It takes place at the rate of something like 10 to the power 23 times per second. You know what that means? 100,000,000,000,000,000 times a second. That is the rate at which we, these solid material bodies, these good, strong, silent, reliable, hefty men, and these charming ladies, and so forth, you see. That is how we actually exist, materially. 100,000,000,000,000 times we exist and we disappear out of existence. We exist and we disappear out of existence. In what space and time do all the particles that compose us disappear when they go? And where? You see? The one wonderful lesson that we learn out of this, at least I learned it, I don't know. I just don't know. And it's a marvelous state to be in, the state of perpetual wonder. It seems as if it is so, but in actuality it is something different. 20 years ago, I was quite certain about the law of karma. I wasn't quite so certain about rebirth. The popular belief and popular presentation. And the presentation of rebirth in any reincarnational form, to me now, is just utterly nonsensical. It's a misleading form. It's nearly 40 years. It was nearly 40 years of great intellectual distress, struggling with this problem. Then the reincarnational picture went out, but not the reality underlying it. The reality underlying it is this miraculous, this wonderful thing, this pulsation, which is not a reincarnation. It is just perpetual incarnation, again and again. And that's the marvel of it. If you say again and again, you're caught up immediately in the concept of time and space. These are the difficulties of talking about it. But if you really appreciate the difficulties, your intellect becomes freed of the misperception of it. And when you're talking with somebody, you can always sort of, you know, counter whatever mistaken statements may be made. Now, this is a very deep thing, really. Look into some of the implications. If this is the nature of existence, obviously, there is nothing whatsoever for me, the person. This funny little cocoon, this will-o'-the-wisp, which I call, oh, myself. The spark of God which is immortal in me. I am clinging to something which doesn't exist. When I am drowning, I catch hold of empty space and say, ah, now I shall be held up by it. Now, if I do know that it is space, I will be held up by it. But because I misconceive it and think it's some solid anchor, I drown. That is what happens to us with doctrines and dogmas. You see, this is the great difficulty. So now, there is nothing for me, because there is no permanent me to deal with. And even if there is something which we may legitimately call, refer to as I myself, whilst this pattern is here, for purposes of identification, it is useful to say I, useful to say Feroz Mehta. You see? If I gave a false name, say the name of a millionaire, I might be had up, won't I, for attempting to do something wrong against the law. Then karma would certainly descend upon me with swift retribution. Nothing for me whatsoever. If he cannot start that way, believe me, the religious life and whatever we do and name as the religious life or the yogic life or any sort of life is irreligious, is a falsity. When this petty self, this misconception of a petty self is out, the soul is pure. And then grace operates. Shall I put it in a symbolical form? When there is no more self here, and I give up, as I say, completely give up, I don't know, then the Lord says, oh, that chap's done away with himself, oh, I'll give him the world. There you are, my friend, take it and enjoy it, it is all yours. It's the meaning of grace. And you see, there's peace, there is happiness. When the misconceptions are out, the reality is allowed to play freely in me. As long as I cling to doctrines and dogmas and want teachings, want instruction, which is all tied up in the prison house of ideas and rigid conceptions, then I am my own jailer, my own tormentor. Let them all slip away. In the Skanda and the Maitreya Upanishads, it is said that the body is the temple of the Most High. The dweller in the temple is no other than Shiva. The dweller in the temple is not Feroz or Michael or Beryl or Sophia or anybody. That is the dweller in the temple. And if that dweller in the temple is this ultimate creative power and reality, acausal, consequenceless, absolutely free, what place has my potty little doctrine of karma or rebirth? in that transcendent context. St. Paul, know ye not ye are the temple of the Most High? So you see, what is important for the holy life, for the fulfillment and flowering of whatever is trying to flower through man, what is important for that is to let transcendence take over. The isolatively self-conscious, separative ego, am the usurper sitting on the throne or pretending to sit on the throne of the Most High. I am the usurper. And the end of any usurper is, like in Richard Strauss's Till Eulenspiegel, death. Death, the wages of sin. But you live, and may you live, really live, as life would live you. That is the art of living. The reality of harmony and law and order is not a reality which is the consequence of a mere putting together. It is a reality of perpetual creativeness, of creative action. Now this creative action works itself out in our own lives through the psyche. From what has gone before, we may say, well, if there is no justice, no reward, no punishment, no consequence for what we think and say and do, then we might as well just give up everything and go wild. Or one may say, oh well, I can do anything I like and get away with it if I am powerful enough, if I am clever enough, knavish enough, skillful enough, I can get away with it. It's totally impossible to get away with anything. There is no external justice here, no external spiritual or psychological police force or court of law or anything which deals with the whole situation. In all this, we must never forget one fundamental fact. All through our lives, every single thought and feeling, every word, every action produces its impress upon one's own psyche. Any thought, any idea, any emotion, any stimulus, impulse, energy which comes to us, anything which rises up from within us, in fantasy, in imagination, in desire, and so forth, is continuously registering in the psyche. And it registers in the psyche not statically, but dynamically, because it is a living energy. Now, karma is not therefore some external mechanism to produce an equilibration for the good we do, the wrong we do, and so on and so on. Karma is the living reality of the functioning of energies within myself. They are all in my psyche. They constitute me. Therefore, the least misleading way of regarding karmic forces, karmic energies, is this. I am my karma. My karma is me. They are not two different things. Now, just as all the bodily conditions in the living body, my heart, my liver, bloodstream, all the rest of it, the food I take and drink I take and so forth, they are all living forces which are continuously affecting the body, so too, every single thought, feeling, word, action, every stimulus is a living force in my being. And since it is a living force in my being, it inevitably works itself out. It is as simple as that. This is how karma works. And no one can escape it. Our trouble in trying to understand karma and trying to intellectually twist karma to fit our particular desires for what we call justice in terms of equilibration produce unanswerable situations. Take the case of a Torquemada or a Hitler or a Genghis Khan or somebody. How are you going to dole out to them the reward or punishment for what they have done? Hitler was responsible for the destruction of 30 million lives. Are you going to apply the Mosaic law, a life for a life? Good old Hitler will come 30 million times, we'll have to go through all the trouble and bother of catching hold of him, trying him, sentencing him, executing him. And then all the emotions and upsets which will be roused in millions of people who will say, for goodness sake, can't we stop this nonsense? Isn't it awful? Who is going to adjust all that? But of course it can't be adjusted. It should be perfectly obvious that it can't. And if that were the case, if that sort of thing were the case, good heavens, poor old Mother Earth would have to have a lifespan of thousands of billions of millions of years in order that these wretched people's karmas may be worked out. It's as ridiculous as that and as impossible as that. But see it this way. Whatsoever one does, thinks, and so on, is a living force inside oneself. I myself am immediately affected by it. We all know, we knew this long, long ago in fact, that any emotional state immediately produces various secretions in the body. See, adrenaline is comes out and this, that and the other happens. You see, whether it's fear, whether it's love, whether it's passion, whether it's anger, whatever it is, the immediate chemical reactions take place in the body and there is an effect produced. I'm talking purely of the physical side at the moment. You see? And the person who gets angry very easily and can't control himself, one day has an apoplectic fit. There's his karma working itself out. Or the person who indulges himself in this, that and the other way, if he indulges himself in the wrong way, uses his sense functions in the ill way, then sooner or later the effects of it all accumulate, and he has a stroke or an ulcer or goodness knows what. So you see, we do not escape our karma. We cannot counter our karma. In the manner in which we imagine that we could counter it. And this is where the presentation in all the religious texts of the past is slightly, if not in some cases, considerably faulty. Take, for instance, the Buddhist-Hindu presentation. They are both alike in this manner. If thoughts of anger and hate arise in you, then counter it with a thought of loving kindness. Go through an intellectual process of reasoning which will make you see that this anger, etc., was an evil thing, and so you counter it this way. It all sounds very good, you see. But this sort of presentation is a presentation born of our analogy of the analogy with physical experience. If the jug of milk upsets on the table, bring a cloth immediately and wipe it out like that, and lo, the table is clean and everything's all right. But living energies don't work out that way. You can't counter it. Where these living energies within the psyche are concerned, every attempt to counter it produces the state of conflict, which gives rise to another situation of difficulty, of disharmony. Now, this is something which is not generally known. If one pays attention in such a manner, in the right manner, if one pays attention and sees that psychical energy working itself out, it does not work itself out in the sense that it is exhausted. Like you may go to the West End with £100 in your pocket in order to spend it on things. Well, your £100 are exhausted when you have spent that money. Observing the psychical energy at work does not exhaust the psychical energy. It transforms it. The stuff is there, everlastingly there. Your psychical energy, it's your soul strength. You see, this is a point which I believe has not been properly looked into. This is where mindfulness has its supreme meaning. This samasati, the mindfulness, is just precisely this kind of thing. It is not a setting going of countering forces, because that merely perpetuates conflict. This is extremely important. This is where we have gone wrong all along the line. Through the ages, very few there are who have come clean out of it and realized perfection. Very few. Now, you will see this manifest in hundreds of cases. People live or strive to live the good life, overcome evil, fight the good fight, and all that sort of stuff and nonsense. It's sheer nonsense, really. You can't fight any good fight. Goodness and fighting are irreconcilables. You can't have wars for freedom, honor, justice. They are totally irreconcilables. So, one observes. And in that process of observation, the transformation takes place. Those people who arrive at a sort of a state of saintship and are regarded as saints by the ignorant devotees who are just lost in admiration and are quite, use the slang word ga-ga about the great master, you see. Those people inside themselves are consumed. They are consumed with their passion, their trouble. But they have this ability to put on the appearance of quietude and serenity and calmness, and the uncritical, blind multitude is deceived by them. Occasionally, they come out with the fact, with the truth. Then the cat is out of the bag. For 25 years, for 50 years, they lived as celibates, beyond all passion and all the rest of it. Did they? Who's kept note of what went on and what goes on now in their minds? If you sometimes are able to watch them very carefully, in a social gathering, you might see sometimes just that flash of a glance in their eyes when they see some woman, which gives the whole secret away. This is the fact. Let them deny it if they can, if they dare. Now, let's have no illusions about it. Look, the truth burns, it sears. But the truth heals. The truth shall make ye whole. And in that is the purity, the happiness, and the real sanctity. Then it comes. So now, these karmic forces within us work themselves out in terms of conflict unless and until we learn this art of watching them in the right way. See the psychical energy bubbling up, working up. Watch its progress. And watch it not merely coldly intellectually, as a scientist looks on at an experiment in the laboratory, but watch it feelingly, with a warm sensitivity, being with it completely, because it is you. It is not outside you. It's only the intellect that projects it outside for the sake of looking at it. You can only look at a thing. You see? All right. That way, being with it, and one's own task is to maintain poise. Now, maintaining poise means not indifference. It means essentially being free of all our preconceptions, our standards, our assumptions, our judgments. Oh, but the master himself told me. Never mind what the master told you. What do you understand and see? Because it is your psyche which is working. The master may have told you, you can eat this and you'll be all right, but you ate it and you got a bellyache. Where now is the master's telling? You see, you've got to be extraordinarily commonsensical, the thing we lack most in the world. Really, we are sadly lacking in good sense all along the line. So, observe it carefully, that live with it, live through it, you see? And you will find that this psychical energy, which was hitherto functioning, just to use the commoner garden word, devilishly, has now become angelic. It's the same psychical energy. You cannot destroy it, you cannot throw it out, you can, through your intelligent, poised watchfulness, let it get transformed. You don't transform it. Don't you ever try to, because you'll try to transform it according to your own petty little intellectual preconceptions. And they are no use. They are another set of sankharas, as the Buddha used to say, quite rightly. See, they are no use. Let it transform. And it will, by itself, come right. And do remember that whatever comes is the right thing. If you find yourself saying, but surely I was told that it will come right, but it hasn't come right now. You know why you say that? Because you have a standard. You want it to come just this way or that way, but not this way. But the Lord God said, no, thus shall it be unto you, my dear. What then? You see, you understand? So karma works itself out fully, continuously, unceasingly, at an extraordinary rate. Now, one other point in this connection, and we'll finish with the whole subject of karma. Recall what was said earlier on this matter. This pulsation, this life, other life, life, other life, being, non-being pulsation. Karma, therefore, is in the immediate now because of this pulsation. And with every pulsation, it's a new creation, remember? A new universe at once present. So karma is in the immediate now. And this infinitesimal fraction of a moment breeds the next infinitesimal fraction of a moment in which the new universe is present. And that new universe, in that sense, is the worked out, the fully worked out karma of the old universe. Now this is what happens to us also. I know one of the great objections, I had to raise it myself in my own mind. But then we do observe that now in my old age I am paying for all my follies in my youth. Having sown wild oats in my youth, now I pay the penalty in creaky bones and failing eyesight and whatnot and whatnot. You know the usual conventional way in which these things are put. Now, why then this time lag, this time gap? Think carefully. I, the ordinary human being, am extremely slow of perception. I am incapable of registering this incredibly rapid pulsation and of appreciating that the very next pulse is different from the old pulse. It all seems to me like just a continuous flow. I can't see the pulsation at all. I am able to be conscious of it only in terms of a continuity, a continuous flow. And only when that point is reached where the difference, where it is impossible not to see the difference, that I say, oh, I see, this is the effect of that cause of 30 or 40 years ago. So this is how we talk in terms of past karma, present karma, future karma. But if you get free of the equilibration idea, if you get free of the reward-punishment idea, and if you are really awake to the action process, creative action in eternity process as such, then you will begin to get the right understanding of karma.